The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the 12th tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the 12th tradition is Hannah.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Stephanie, for asking me to speak. Thank you for asking me last night, because it shortened this experience for me. And I had to give a Spanish presentation this morning in front of 13 people, and it was just like a joke. I wanted to tell them all, later I'm going to be speaking in front of 600 people. But I couldn't, because it would be breaking this tradition. So the long form is, and finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. Which is very beautifully written, I feel. And true. And the thing about the traditions is there's so much to say and also so little. They're very, very simple in nature. They're very straightforward. They have the short form here for us to see. But there is a lot of history behind them. And because this is an open meeting, I don't think it would be beneficial to get too much into that. So I'm going to try to keep to my experience. The truth about the traditions is that we wouldn't have them if there wasn't for a lot of trial and error. We wouldn't have them if there hadn't been a lot of history that had gone into the making of them. And in the 12th tradition, originally this concept of anonymity was because they felt that we would be better served as a secret society, that it would be better for our members if people did not know that they were in AA, because we felt we had to protect their identity and we didn't want them to go around telling everybody that they were in this, club of people who, could not stop drinking. That doesn't add a lot to conversation. So that's the original intention behind this. And then as the membership of AA grew, it was very clear that this anonymity was really a spiritual principle, that actually it didn't have to do so much as with it being a secret, but more that it has to do with humility and ego deflation, and that this really has to do with being one amongst many, being a member amongst other members, not a special member, not a distinguished person, but just being one amongst my fellows. And, this goes twofold, and it's very connected, of course, to the 11th tradition, which is an absolute principle, that at the level of press, radio, and films, we do not break our anonymity, period. But in 12, the explanation that I've read, is that my anonymity is my anonymity. So in terms of my membership, it's up to me to decide who I tell that I'm in AA. And that is to protect me from myself. It's because I'm a human person, and I'm going to make all sorts of blunders in this world, and I certainly don't want to be representing AA when I'm doing that stuff. And so the question that I have to ask myself in terms of my technical anonymity is, am I telling this person that I'm a member of AA in order to be useful, or in order to have some sort of, to make conversation, to explain why I'm not drinking, to get credit for something? What is my motive behind that? And then the other element of this anonymity is, how am I behaving in AA? Like I said, am I being one amongst the many? My fear about speaking tonight was that everyone would think, we've heard her so many times, and that's fine if you are, it's none of my business. But my fear would like me to tell you to try to put some principles before that idea. You know, because the truth is I'm trying to put principles before my personality by speaking too. You know, I'm trying to put some faith and courage into this activity. You know, it's not where I'm most comfortable. But here I am, you know, and so when I'm distinguishing members in AA, like, oh my God, that person again, or, ooh, so-and-so spoke at the meeting, like, that has nothing to do with anonymity, you know, that has nothing to do with us all being the same and equal around here. That's making people special, that's making me less or more special than other people, and it, the problem with that is, in AA, with alcoholic human people, they fail, you know, and so then when the old timer acts like a human alcoholic and I'm devastated because I can't believe that they've acted that way and I want to leave the group because I'm so appalled at the behavior, you know, I can take a look at what's really happening there. You know, oh, right, we're all the same, you know, and that's why I really do the best in life, in AA, in general, in the middle. You know, like with people ahead of me and behind me and shoulder to shoulder with everybody. Like I have to be walking shoulder to shoulder with people. And a story that like I kept thinking about in meditation today when I was thinking about this is when I had like a year sober, I used to really like geek out over my sponsor. Like I just thought she was like so cool. She is. She's all these things still, but like she had these like powerhouse shares and I was like a mute weirdo person, you know, and like I just like she just was so cool to me, you know, and I would like stand outside and wait for the meeting and then I'd be mad when she left and didn't say bye and all this stuff and I would stand with her, you know, outside and wait for her with my friend and she said to us one time, she was like, "You know what, Hannah? I need a fellowship, not a fan club." And I was like, how could you say that to me? And I get it now. You know, I've been thinking a lot about that recently, and it's really because, like, not only is it not going to help me, because she's going to go and, like, seek the help that she deserves for being alcoholic. She's going to go and, you know, be around friends and do all the things that she needs to do as an alcoholic, so it's not personal. And two, like, she deserves that. It's not fair of me to like be watching her like that on a pedestal. So it doesn't really serve anyone in AA to be sort of putting people on pedestals. You know, I need to remember that. I need to remember that the purpose of all of these traditions is for ego deflation, not inflation. You know, not for me to start to feel like. And it's hard. It's really hard. That's why like. Doing the steps is so integral to the understanding of the traditions, because if I'm not taking a look at my behavior, it is easy to get wrapped up in this stuff. Like, it is easy to, like, oh my God, I get to be a moderator at the table. Like, you know, like, it's really hard to not make that into, like, look at me, look what I've done. You know, but the truth is I don't deserve credit for any of this. I could not stop drinking. I could not stop sitting in bed all day. I could not stop wanting to kill myself. You know, and then I came here and I was just led through a process, and then I want to come out the other end and feel special, you know, and feel like I deserve credit for this kind of stuff. And that's not really fair. You know, that's not giving credit where credit is due. So unless I'm, you know, exemplifying the principles instead of my personality, I'm sort of doing a disservice to this entire fellowship. You know, unless I'm trying to make this work speak for itself instead of like Hannah's version of it, I'm sort of, you know, I'm harming this AA as a whole. You know, I'm getting in the way. Because the truth is, and I've said before, like, they didn't teach us, I wasn't taught 12 principles in the steps, and then it's subsequently 12 more in the traditions, only to learn that, like, what I really need to be doing is, you know, be a little bit easier on other people. You know, like I do need to be easier on other people. But what they're saying here is like it's still on you. You know, it's still on you. You know, like they're not saying here like don't be hard on yourself. Don't worry, everybody has a lot of personalities. We know when you come. My sponsor calls this the Hollywood meeting. He's like, when you go to the Hollywood meeting, I know there's a lot of personalities, and that's true. But like the only personality that's going to endanger my sobriety is mine. You know, and so if I'm not working on using these principles as a way of life for myself, I'm going to be my worst enemy, and I'm going to edge myself out of AA, not everybody else and their wonderful personalities. So thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Ryan Jay.
My name is Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. That's a lot of people. My sobriety date's October the 8th of 2009, and my sponsor is now JD. I got sober in California, and then I moved to Chicago for, thank you. Then I moved to Chicago for the past 4 years, and I just moved here a couple months ago. And, you know, I would say, you know, to kind of start out, I mean, if you're new, welcome, you know. I spent a long time trying to get sober. I mean, I attended my first meeting when I was 16 and a half years old, and I didn't get sober until I was 22. And I started drinking at 16, and by 6 months later, I had to be, like, physically detoxed from alcohol. I mean, it was right from the start for me. And, you know, my thing was, is it was pretty apparent, like, early on, I drank very, very differently than everybody else around me, you know? The people in high school were drinking because they thought it was cool, or, you know, that everyone else was doing it, and like that was my original intent, you know. And then it was like right from there it did something special for me that it doesn't do for the average person, you know. And I pursued it with a lot of zest. And when you drink alcohol in the quantities that I do, you end up doing a lot of stupid stuff, you know, and drawing a lot of attention to yourself. And I got in a ton of trouble really early on, and I got a lot of consequences. And then, you know, brief overview of what it looked like when I drank. I mean, it was one consequence after another, and then it started into this cycle, you know, where I would, like, get in a whole bunch of trouble, stop drinking for, like, a short period of time, clean up my actions, start doing the right things, and then, like, little by slowly, like, I would start drinking again. And then, like, it would all start falling down around me. And I repeated the cycle over and over and over. I got to college, I did really well, then I got in a whole bunch of trouble, then I would stop drinking for a little bit, then I would talk myself into, okay, it's not going to happen this time, and I would, like, do it again, over and over and over. Then I got, like, kicked out of college, then I went to, like, rehabs and, like, more and more, and then I would, like, get out, get an apartment, get a job, do okay for a little bit, make sure that everybody in my employment, like, knew that I wasn't drinking, and then I would start drinking, which gets really weird, and then, you know, then I would, like, gradually get fired and then repeat the process, like, over and over and over again. You know, and throughout this process, I did a lot of harms to a lot of people, you know. I mean, my parents had front row seats to everything, you know. My mom was, like, I mean, she sat through all of it, you know. And I just remember, I mean, I look back on it now, and it's like, those are the things, right? It's like I look at my mother in a completely different way, you know. I remember, like, standing in front of her and her just looking at me and being like, how could you, you know. Like when I got drunk and stole her car and didn't show up to my sister's wedding, you know? And like, you know, having this supposed to be like my sister's important day, and it's like everyone's talking about her loser brother that doesn't show up to the wedding, you know? And it's like those are the harms that I caused to people, you know? And it's like I didn't care, you know, at the time. Like I just, and I felt bad about it, sure, you know? But if you asked me like why I did those things, like I couldn't give you an answer, you know? The truth of the matter was, is, like, I took her car, got into a car accident, got scared, and ran away. And that's pretty much my story of my whole life. I get into trouble, I get scared, and I run away, you know? And, you know, what ended up happening was, like, I moved around a lot. I lived in, like, Denver, then I got a job at the Grand Canyon, and I was, like, a bartender out there. And, I mean, if you're, like, crazy alcoholic, suicidal, and, like, on, like, a rampage, I don't suggest moving next to, like, a large hole in the ground. You know, like that's just my experience, you know, and like everything else, I eventually got fired from there for drinking, and then like another cycle happened, you know, And then I was living out there, and I got my third and final DUI, and I was in a national park, and I got prosecuted by the federal government. And I got sentenced to live in a halfway house for a year. And they didn't have any there, so they kind of gave me the option where I wanted to move. So I moved to San Diego, found one, like, on Craigslist. It looked really pretty. I got there, and a few days in, I realized I moved into an all-gay halfway house. And, like, but everyone was really nice to me. It was a very beautiful location, so I stayed there, you know? And I stayed there, and I was working at a bar, telling them I worked at a burger restaurant, and I was still drinking, you know, while living in a halfway house and, like, living this life. I mean, I took a 60-day coin when I was 2 days sober. I've done that actually a couple times, not going to lie. And, you know, and it ended up, like, ultimately what happened there, right, is I got caught, got kicked out of the halfway house. I went and lived at the Ocean Beach Hostel for a week pretending to be a tourist because you can't really tell people, like, hey, dude, just got kicked out of a halfway house, so I'm just staying here in the interim until they let me back in. You know, people think that's weird, you know? And what ended up happening was, I took my last drink out there. Didn't know that it was going to be my last drink, you know? And 3 weeks sober, I moved to Chicago. I had no intention on, you know, really doing this thing. And I showed up and, like, went to, like, an AA meeting. And I went to one the next day. And for some odd reason, I can't explain to you why, I looked through an AA directory and there, saw that there was a young people's meeting going on down the street from my house. And I showed up there, and there was a man that gave a lead, and it was the first time ever in an AA meeting he explained exactly what my problem was, you know? I mean, he explained exactly what was going on in my head my whole life, you know? Like how my head just thinks all the time, I'm so resentful, I'm like restless, irritable, and discontented, and then I drink and it all goes away, you know? And he articulated that in a manner that no one else had ever articulated that to me, you know? And I got done with the meeting, and I, like, walked up to him, and, like, his shoulders were, like, set back, had, like, a big smile on his face, and was just so at ease and comfortable with himself. And I was, like, scared and freaking out and didn't know, like, what I was doing, but, you know, felt like a 14-year-old trapped in a man's body, you know? Just like a man boy, just like, you know? And, like, I'm, like, standing in front of him, you know, and he's like, how you doing, man? I'm like, I'm good, you know? And, like, you know, we ended up spending time together, you know? And he's like, how you getting home? I'm like, oh, I'm a walk. I'm, like, 2 blocks away. And he's like, why don't I give you a ride? You know, we ended up spending an hour and a half in his car talking. And he outlined my entire life and explained to me, like, everything, you know? And listened to my story and then, like, went directly through the book. Basically, like, went through, like, the doctor's opinion with me. And I had never heard any of that information before, you know? And when we got done, he was like, Ryan, it's like this idea that you have in your head that, like, eventually it's going to stop. That eventually you're going to mature and be able to drink normally. Or that you're just going to be the guy that doesn't drink, you know? He's like, that will never happen for you. You're going to spend the remainder of your life repeating this cycle over and over and over again. And he's like, I'm sure that you've been to meetings and heard people say, like, to drink is to die, you know? And he's like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you told me you're suicidal, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, so it's probably not very scary to you, right? He's like, how would it feel to live the next 60 years of your life repeating the cycle over and over and over again, you know? And he's like, if you don't do what's outlined in this book and what's directed, you're going to do that for the rest of your life, you know? And he's like, and you're going to miss out on everything that I've ever experienced inside AA, you know? And I met him the next morning. We went to a meeting, and I kind of go back a little bit. You know, when I got out of his car, that was, I don't know what happened. I mean, it was the first time I had ever felt, like, real hope in my life, you know? And that was the night that everything changed, you know? I got out of there, and I went to the meeting the next day and spent the whole day hanging out with him. We, like, went to the meeting and, like, hung out all day. And I did exactly what he told me to do, you know? And, I mean, I fought a lot along the way. You know, I'm belligerent. But, like, you know, and as a result of that, you know, I went through this process, and, you know, I have a perfect first step today, you know? I no longer have an obsession with alcohol. You know, and when I was new, for all those, like, 6 years of trying to get sober, the hardest thing for me to do, right, was I would show up to AA, and I would, like, see this stuff, and I would walk past bars and see people drinking, and would stand there and just be like, this just isn't fair, I'm 22 years old, why can't I just have fun like everyone else, you know, see everybody else having a good time, and it's just like, and now I have to go to these stupid AA meetings, you know, and I don't really understand what people are talking about, you know, and just, like, feeling like I'm getting left out, and eventually, like, I end up drinking again, you know. I don't feel that way anymore. I don't walk past bars and look at people and feel like I'm missing out. I haven't missed out on anything. I lead a life today that's better than I've ever known, you know? I've gone through the steps. I've gone through that humbling experience of going through and doing a fourth and a fifth step with my sponsor, you know, and feel that rush through your veins where you're just so ashamed of the things that you've done, you know. And I've come out and I've seen, like, what my life can look like as I start to change. And that's the real thing here, right, is that change. And that's what I always wanted to do, is I wanted to be, like, a changed person. I just had no idea how to do it, you know. But I got very, very lucky and came across some incredible teachers who showed me, like, how to lead and live a new way of life, you know. And if you're new, you know, I mean, there's so many things that were told to me, but, I mean, I really hope that you're able to have an experience similar to mine, you know. And I got that through working the steps, growing close with a sponsor, never, like, stop admitting when I'm wrong, you know, and always trying to be, like, of help to, like, newer guys. I mean, that was, like, really, like, where I got free, you know. And today, like, I don't suffer from the things that I used to, like, suffer from. Like, my head doesn't rattle all night while I'm trying to go to sleep. And, you know, for a lot of things like that, I'm very, very grateful. And thank you for the opportunity to speak. Thanks.
And our main speaker tonight is Amanda.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Hold on. Sorry, I've been waiting for that. Oh, boy. I want to thank Stephanie for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege. This is my home group. My sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. And I have a couple of nights step amends left, and I'm practicing 10, 11, and 12. I'm extremely hoarse, so just hang out with me. I don't know. I'm just incredibly grateful to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is, you know, if you have alcoholism, this is the best thing on the block right now. And, you know, and I'm incredibly grateful to have found this place, because what I found is that most alcoholics die drunk. Most alcoholics don't even know that there's another way of living. You know, and some do and just can't quite grasp this program. So I am just so grateful that I was able to. I came in here with a bottom that I never want to go back to. And I had a hopelessness within my heart that was so deep that I was basically ready to do whatever you told me to do, and I did. I was desperate, you know. I picked up a drink when I was 15 years old. I did it all by myself. I loved the lines in the book where it said, "The thought crossed his mind." Like, that's all it was. The thought crossed my mind that to have a couple of drinks during fourth period in high school, in the girls' bathroom, all by myself. No peer pressure, nobody. I just had the idea. I don't know where it came from. And I went into the girls' bathroom, and I took a couple of drinks, and I felt incredible. And I was looking just to, like, add a little color, I had music theory the next class, and I was looking to, you know, liven that up a little bit. But instead, I had this, like, ease and comfort that came over me. Like, it was a new way of feeling that I didn't know I needed a new way of feeling, to be honest with you. And I felt that. And you know, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a feel-good junkie. And I'll do anything that's going to make me feel good, and that made me feel incredible. And that's what I wanted, and that's what I chased. I did not ease into alcoholism. I had it. I didn't ease into consequences. I had them immediately. The book talks about that physical allergy, you know. That's why I didn't ease into alcoholism. I had a physical allergy right off the bat. I took a couple of drinks. It flipped the switch inside of me where I wanted more and more and more and more. And they describe it as a phenomenon of craving. And my craving was satisfied when I took a face plant, and that was it. Even throwing up. I threw up, and then I went back and drank more. It was like I threw up, you know, room for more, you know. That was my thinking. And, you know, I loved it. I just loved the way it made me feel. And I had this, right off the bat, I wasn't the smartest kid. You know, I had this, I call it delusional, but it's just stupid. I had this idea that, like, I was a little scared of my mother. So I was like, I can't get caught. So I won't drink at home, and I won't drink on the weekends. So I'll drink in school, you know. When you get caught in school, they call your mother. So I was drinking a lot in school, and they called my mother, and they lightened it a little bit for her. I excelled in athletics, and I had great coaches that were just like kind of lightening what was really happening to my mother and to my family. And they're like, "She's fine, she's fine. She's just being a little bit of a wise guy." They also knew that I had a lot of things going on at home. I was having a difficulty. My parents just split up. We went, I'm going to keep this short. My parents split up. It was not a pretty scene. We went from a nice house with a nice family to a tiny apartment with just my mother. My brother took off. My dad moved out, and it happened literally overnight. And I had to grow up really fast. Didn't make me an alcoholic, you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, I still had a physical allergy. Whether my parents were together, whether I had a big, happy family or not, I still had a physical allergy to alcohol, and I wanted to feel better. But I played off of that for a long time. I had a lot of coaches that were like, all right, she's a little bit of a wise guy. She's drinking a lot, but she's having a tough time at home. You know, so let's not kick her out of school. Let's not do any of this. Once I heard that I could get kicked out of school for the things that I was doing, I was like, oh, yeah, I am having a hard time at home. My drinking is out of control. What do I need to do? Backfired on me because they had me in, I had to go to counseling twice a week. I had to see the school counselor twice a week. And then I had to see an outside counselor. And they were incredible because it backfired on me because all of them were saying, you know, you need to go to AA. And I was sitting in my first AA meeting at 16. And obviously I didn't stay. I had a lot more drinking to do, but what it did, it ruined my drinking completely. You know, I'm so grateful for those people. I made amends to all of them, by the way. So grateful because they got me to a place. They knew I wasn't going to stop drinking. They basically just got me through high school without getting kicked out, without killing myself. And they got me into a meeting of AA knowing that if I was an alcoholic, it was going to ruin my drinking and it was only going to be a matter of time that hopefully I would make it back. And now when people come to me, I think I have a drinking problem. Like, I take them to a meeting because if they're an alcoholic, I've just ruined it for them. And if they're not an alcoholic, they're just not going to have zero effect. Just to backtrack for a second, I come from this incredible family. It's a large Irish family. You got names in there like McSherry, Sullivans, Keenan. You know, it's a wild party, you know. But they were split. You know, my dad's side of the family were a bunch of drunks, and my mom's side of the family were like the other. Like, if you have a big Irish family, they're going to be drunk, or they're going to be like neurotic, paranoid, I don't drink, I belong in Al-Anon type attitudes. And that was my family was split right down the middle. And it was great. You know, you had holidays at my dad's side. You had, like, my cousin Bobby rolling down the keg. You know, and then on my mom's side, you had, would you like a cranberry and seltzer? You know, Diet Coke. You know, I was like, just give me water. This is terrible. And my family's hilarious. And then... So I was just confused. I didn't know which way I was going. The first time, I have an older brother. The first time one of us came home drunk, it was my brother. You know, my dad's hysterical laughing, and my mom is wrapping the entire bedroom in plastic so he doesn't throw up. You know, and it looked like a scene out of Dexter, like an inside of the plastic bag. And it was just like, you know, so I was just a confused kid, you know. And I clearly took the path of the drinkers. And, you know, I'm describing my mother. I talk about my mother for a second because she was a huge part in my whole process and still very much is. She, when she moved us into, we moved into a tiny apartment. It was just us. We had no money. She worked her tail off and still relied on that check that was coming in. And I just had to grow up fast. But she was one of the strongest women. And she knew the consequences that were going to come from taking certain decisions. But she knew she had to do it in order to get us a better way of living. And she didn't drink, she didn't take any drugs, she didn't take any pills. This woman was a rock-solid woman. She had a spiritual life that I can't even describe to you, that I've learned a lot from. And, you know, she was rock-solid. And the thing that brought her down was my drinking. And I wasn't even drinking in front of her. It was this idea that her kid was off at school, throwing it down harder than anything, not knowing what phone call she was going to get next. And a couple, you know, she got a couple of bad phone calls. One bad phone call that she got was from me because I was encouraged to tell her. I went away on spring break. I went on a 7-day bender like I had never experienced. And I was just drinking for 7 days straight. And I was going in and out of blackouts the whole time. I thought I was having a blast from what I remember. And we went out one night, and this was in a particular bad night when I was, my roommates had to, dress me, put makeup on me, put my shoes on me, and push me out the door. These were great friends. They should have just said, stay home. They're like, no, you have to come. And we went out, and I'll keep this very general and very brief, but it did not end well. I ended up in a corner. I came out of a blackout, and there was, I was, you know, it was in a, how do I put this? I was being assaulted in the corner, and I came out of a blackout. And somehow I got to my friend. We got the cops. I ended up in the hospital all night. I ended up working with detectives all night, and I'm still hammered, except I'm remembering everything. And we come back. And I could not go home and look at my mother. And this my roommate's father was like, "You really need to tell your mom because you need more medical attention. You need to go to, you know." So I was like, "All right, fine." I tell my mom, destroys her. She throws me, you know, and you know she's great. She throws me into 1,000 doctor appointments, and then I go back to school and I just continue to drink and drink and drink and drink, and my drinking took such a dark turn. And now, not only was it, now I just wasn't drinking for like, you know, the feel of it. I was now drinking with negative self-esteem, complete self-hate, no self-worth, no respect. I just didn't care. I was drinking with a vengeance. I just did not care. And my mom knew that. And I came home, maybe it was a couple weeks before I stopped drinking. And this is where I didn't realize what I was doing to her until that moment where I was like in her sock drawer. I don't know what I was doing in her sock drawer. I hope I was looking for socks. I found a bottle of Xanax, you know, and it was in that moment that I knew that like this, she is not okay. She's not okay. You know, she's not a, you know, and it was prescribed by who was going to be my soon to be stepfather, you know, so I knew he was just trying to keep her standing, and she was just trying to keep her standing. And it broke my heart, you know. But the powerlessness and the delusion that I suffered from, what did I do next? I took the bottle. You know, this was the thing that she needed to survive, and I took it because I was going out that night and wanted to mix it. You know, and I remember that day so clearly. I didn't want to take it, but how could I not? 3 weeks later, I ended up getting sober. And what had happened was, it was all sophomore year. I was living in this, Melissa calls it a crack house. There was no crack. But if there was, that's what you would call it. And one of my roommates actually just came in, who I lived with, in that suite. The thing was disgusting. The thing was like, you would ash cigarettes on the floor. There was bottles. There was water bottles filled with vodka. You know, we had this one roommate, she was ironing, and she poured vodka in the iron by accident. She picked up a thing. You know, she comes running in. She's like, "I just put vodka in the iron." And I was like, "Who irons?" You know, and it was like, it was a scene. It was just a scene. It was disgusting, and no one would come visit. I was fine with it. I lived there. I was fine with it. And but all that year, all I wanted to do was stop drinking. I just wanted to stop drinking so bad. I knew there was AA, but I didn't want to go to AA. I was 19. And I started looking online for a quick fix. Google wasn't available, so I had to get creative in my searches. And it was an email list. You can email people who are sober. And I emailed this one woman. Her name was Michelle, and she emailed me back. She was sober 9 years. She was 29 years old. She had a lot of similarities here. And she just shared her experience. We had some similar war stories, so she got my attention. She never told me, she was wonderful. She never said anything about AA. And I continued to drink for another 3 or 4 months when I was talking to her. And I was really starting to see that I had, there was no control over my alcoholism. There was no control over my drinking. It says it like, I love the line in We Agnostics where it says, if you find you cannot quit entirely or when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take. Like, that was my story. I had no control over what I took. And I knew, you know, when I go out, Ryan said it great, like, when you consume so much alcohol, you're going to do stupid stuff. Like, I've done a lot of stupid stuff. I had mountains of evidence that says, you do not drink safely, don't do it anymore. And I just kept picking up the drink. You know, I've broken bones, I've had earrings ripped out, I've been within a lot of inappropriate people. Like, everything says, you should not drink, and I just kept drinking. And now I'm at a place where I really want to stop drinking, and now I can't stop drinking. This woman emailed me back and forth. Finally, I said, "How do you get sober?" And she goes, "I go to AA. you know. And I heard, I thought that was a bomb. It just hit, an AA bomb. I do not want to go to AA. Even the sound of it, AA. I hate it. I hate the sound of AA. My family calls it AA. You know, like, I hate when they say it, too. I just shut the door. I was like, no, I'm not going there. Do you have another solution? And she's like, no, this is the only way I know how to do it. And I'm like, wonderful. And I had one more. I drank one more night. I drank a whole bunch. I took a whole bunch of pills, and I was driving home on the Long Island Expressway trying to get home. And I got home. I kissed the ground. I swore I never was going to do that again. And I've driven a lot, but now at this point, I was like, I just can't do this anymore. So I was up the next day, ready to go to a meeting. Got diverted. I had to go to work. I found myself at my brother's house that night, and I started drinking again. I got through my second beer, and I saw that I was like, this, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to get you sober. And so the next day, I went to an AA meeting, and the woman that I was emailing lived in Philadelphia. What had happened was is that I was now incapable of talking to people face-to-face. I couldn't call people on the phone. I had completely withdrawn from society. Thanks. You know, my alcoholism, you know, alcoholism is progressive. I drink more. I drink more and more and more, but the moments that I'm sober are getting worse, too. My anxiety is getting worse. My paranoia is getting worse. You know, my shame, my disgust, everything is just getting worse and worse and worse. So at this point, I can't call. I can't look at you. And so I refused to call this woman. This woman was like, can you please just call me? And I'm like, absolutely not. I'm never calling you. And this is all done by email. AOL. You know? I can't believe that it still exists. I went to a meeting, and I actually put my hand up. And I got, of course, I got attacked by women, which was, you know, what we do here. You know, if you don't want phone numbers, don't put your hand up. But you know, there were some great members in that. There were some great people in that group that knew how uncomfortable I was, and they just passed me a piece of paper that said, "This is my phone number. I'll be at this meeting tomorrow at 7 p.m. Why don't you come meet me?" That's what I did. You communicated with me for the first couple of months in emails and passing notes, and that got me to meetings. That was in Long Island. I eventually went back to school for my junior year. That woman, I eventually called the woman in Philadelphia, and she became like an interim sponsor. She didn't have steps in her life, which was fine because she helped me so much. She was the first person that I was ever comfortable with, and she planned my meetings for me. She said, you're going to go to this one. My first New York, I went to Chock Full of Nuts on the Upper West Side. I met a woman named Maria, who a lot of you remember. She brought me over to the Atlantic Group. She told me she was her sponsor. I couldn't say, she was the opposite of me. She couldn't stop talking. So I was just a lot of nodding, you know, and she threw me into steps, you know. And what I learned about alcoholism is that, you know, it's hopeless. There is nothing I can do about it. And when I went through that first step process of reviewing my drinking and taking a look at my drinking and learning about alcoholism, I see that, you know, I have a body that can't handle alcohol, and I have a mind that needs it. You know, it doesn't work. And as a result, I'm completely hopeless. And I need something greater than myself. And I had a lot of problem with I said I was willing to do the God thing, but when it came down to practical application of putting a God in my life, I didn't believe, and I didn't trust. The only thing I was capable of doing for those first, not couple years, for many years into AA was trusting the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, 12-step work, and the fellowship. I relied on you guys heavily. And that's why it's like I look out at Ava and I see Vince and Peggy like and Stephanie. I see the same faces over and over and over again. That's what I relied on. And it's what I do today. Sometimes I don't want to be here, but I've learned that I am expected to be here because I could be a face that somebody is looking at right now. And, you know, that's what carried me. And Maria threw me into the steps. I did my inventory. She said that, like, you know, if you do these steps, you will get a power that will help relieve you of your alcoholism. You will not drink again if you do this. And I was like, I don't believe you, but fine. And she just said, sit tight and have fun while you're waiting, you know. And that's exactly what I did. I was 20 years old. I was a junior. I got through my senior year. I didn't talk for the first couple of years. My first friend was Zilka, who a lot of you know. She just moved here from Germany. She did not speak English, right? It was a match made in heaven. She was my best friend. She couldn't talk, I couldn't talk, and we hung out. She would ask me, we were at pockets of enthusiasm, and the speaker gets up, and she's like, I come from a large Irish family, and everyone's like, ah, and she leans over, and she's like, what does this mean, Irish Catholic family? And I just was like, drunks. And she's like, oh. You know, that was our relationship. What does this mean? And I would explain it. And what happened was, through the course of the steps, doing an inventory, making amends, you know, I went back, I made amends to my mom. That relationship repaired very quickly. She loves Alcoholics Anonymous. She loves the Atlanta group. She's in love with Stephanie. They have their own relationship today. And that repaired very, very quickly. You know, the relationship with my... it repaired so quickly, the fact that my mom eventually turned around and made amends to me. You know what I mean? I'm like, what are you doing? I was the one. You know, she was just like, I just loved you so much, I don't know if I did a good enough job. And I was just like, alcoholism wasn't your fault. I was like, the decisions that you made gave me this life that I have today. And, the relationship with my dad took a very long time. It is still a work in progress. But I made amends. It was so uncomfortable. I just wanted to stab myself. I hated making amends to him. And I got no freedom from it. I'm sorry. I walked away being like, oh, I hate this. But what happened was, is he called me up one day. I couldn't talk to this man. He called me up one day and he was like, you want to go scuba diving? I was like, sure. We connected over sports and that was it. He went to every single one of my soccer games. We were talking about him. We went to dinner on Sunday and we were just having tons and tons of laughs about, like, he got thrown out of the game. I got thrown out of the game. Like, we're the same people. And he called me up. He was like, you want to go scuba diving? I was like, yeah, whatever. So I started going on an annual scuba diving trip with him. And that was the beginning of our relationship repairing. And once again, it was perfect. And this is where, you know, now I have a God in my life and I can see that he was there the whole time. You know, those scuba diving trips, like, again, you don't talk. You're under the water. You know what I mean? I didn't realize that. I'm going to spend 7 days on a boat with my dad with no cell phone service at 4 years of sobriety, but you're diving from the moment you wake up to the moment you pass out, and then you're so tired you just go to sleep. And our relationship started to develop. He did not like AA. You know what he told me? I've said this before. I told him I was gay, and he was like, all right, what are you going to do? You know, yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? I told him I was in... when I told him I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, he's like, why didn't you come to me first? You know, we could have figured this out. I was like, I know, but this is working for me. And then he dropped lines like, you know, you just replaced your addiction with meetings. You know, I'd be like, all right, just back off. But I was taught, you know, to just keep my mouth shut, keep showing up, and take it. And so our relationship started to develop, and one of the fun things, you know, the cool thing was is that he married this very, very nice Russian woman who has a son, Serge. Serge does not speak English. And he called me up one day and says, your stepbrother, Serge, has a drinking problem. Do you think you can help him? You know, he's like, I've seen it work for you. I had 10 years of sobriety. This took 10 years. He's like, I've seen it work for you. Do you think it could help him? And I'm like, absolutely. You know, and I put together a little arena of this group helped me. I got a big book in Russian, and I passed the package along. I took him to his first meeting. It was a Russian-speaking meeting in Brighton Beach, which was fascinating. I didn't know what was going on, but, you know, I love when people, like, you know, I was in a meeting in another language, and I knew exactly what was going on. And it was like, no, you did not. I was like, Russian, I was like, no. I knew where I was, and I saw and the cool thing was I saw my stepbrother's face kind of like, you know, calm down. So I knew what was happening. I had no idea where we were in the meeting. And, and that turned around, you know what I mean? I eventually became this, like, the point person of my family, which is something I didn't want, but they gave it to me anyway, where I was called upon, like, oh, so-and-so's having a nervous breakdown. Can you go talk to her? you know, you know, that was the fun things. And I'd be like, no, I'm an alcoholic. She's just having a nervous breakdown. And but what had happened was I was this over emotional kid. I was angry. I was over emotional. I was getting into arguments and fights, and they made no sense. And they would hide things from me. You know, one of the things when my parents split up, there was a lot of information I didn't have because they didn't think I could handle it. And then it came out slowly. Now, like, through this process and stuff like that, I became that point person. You know, my dad had a big heart surgery about a year and a half ago. And he handed me the envelope and said, "This, you know, I don't want to give this to your brother. You know, you take the envelope because I think you'll be able to handle it." And it was his will, you know, and I flipped through it, of course, to see where it was. And he made a joke. And he's like, "Stop it." I was like, "Okay, I'm just trying to lighten the mood." My family's a bunch of jokesters. He goes, you know, if something happens, my dad's an older guy and he's not healthy. You know, so this was the risk we were going into. And he goes, you know, and you're going to make the decisions if there's a decision that needs to be made. And he goes, if I give the decision to your brother, he'll never make it and I'll be alive for the rest of, you know, of the world. He goes, and your stepmother will probably pull it too quick. And he's just like, I feel you will hit it right in the middle. You know what I mean? You know, and then I'm trying to think of some other things. A lot of you have heard these stories, but it's my story. It hasn't changed. A couple of years ago, this one was good. Let's see if I can get through this one. We had a sudden passing in my family. It was my uncle, he was a young guy, and it was heartbreaking. And the reason I bring it up is because I can see where it was self-centeredness versus God in the experience. Was I going to make this about myself, or was I going to help my family? And it took an army, you know what I mean? It took Stephanie. It took a lot of inventory writing. Took a lot of my wife, Melissa, is in the program. It took a lot of her. It took a lot of Ava, who's her sponsor, to get through this, and to keep me, you know, not making a scene. I can make a scene. And I just, like, and I remember, like, up until that point, I was struggling with God. I just could not believe. I was 11 and a half years sober. I just could not believe that God was actually going to take care of me. I had nothing going on in my life. I just didn't believe. Stephanie just kept saying, praying, 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 praying. Keep going, keep going. It'll get it. You'll get it. You'll get it. You'll get it. And then he passes away. And now I'm really confused. You know, and I have my brother, we're identical. He's just a little bit taller. You know, he swore off God forever. He said, there is no God to take something like this from us. And I went another direction. First time in my entire life, I chose to go the other direction of, well, maybe there is something that's orchestrating all of this, just because I can't make any sense of this. You know, it talks about, like, reason and intellect only brought us so far. And for a long time in AA, I relied on the reason and the intellect that I can figure this one out. I can take opposite action on my own strength, a pat on the back from my sponsor, and that worked for a while. Eventually, it stopped working. I needed something stronger. And in that moment, I chose to go a different direction, that maybe there is something that is guiding us here. And after that process was over, I went back to church. I did it my own way. I wasn't doing the Sunday thing because it brought back horrible memories. But I would go in the middle. I would go on a Wednesday at 12:30 in a tiny little church downtown, and it worked. And I was starting to feel a presence of a higher power greater than Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And I developed a spiritual practice that works for me. It didn't, and it's nothing spectacular. The reason I'm bringing it up is because for a long time I felt I was doing something wrong in AA, that I couldn't quite grasp the God concept, and others were. The thing I can hang my hat on, though, was that Stephanie just kept saying, seek, 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 just keep seeking. You know, and I can always hang my hat on that I've always been a seeker. And then one day it just clicked. And there's a line in our book that I love so much. It says, God would want us to keep our heads in the cloud, but our feet on the ground. That is where our work is to be. And it brings together this idea of spirituality, but practicality. That this is where I'm supposed to be helping alcoholics. I'm supposed to be bringing in hope and strength to another sick and suffering alcoholic. That is my spiritual practice today. I get centered so that I'm able to do that in my prayer and meditation. However, I cannot live in prayer and meditation, otherwise I'll never get anything done. But that took my sobriety and took it to another level. And, you know, I've been active in AA the whole time. I haven't left. I've always had sponsee service commitments. I've always done the thing, always done the do, whatever. But I couldn't quite taste the freedom. And I realized that it was just my, there's many lines in our book, but if you look in our big book, it says a lot of things about new attitude, proper attitude, better attitude, a simple certain attitude. It takes a certain attitude. The reason I wasn't getting this God concept is because I didn't have a certain attitude. I didn't have an attitude of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to believe in something else other than me and AA. Once I got the attitude, then I started to feel it. And then I truly, truly felt the promises of this program. And I say it like, you know, if you're struggling, you don't have to go 11 years without finding a God. Like, get the attitude. The thing that gets the attitude is pain, unfortunately. So anyway, I'm done. Thank you.